podcast answering the community's most burning questions, the basics of what you guys are looking to hear. And I'm just going to let you kind of roll these off from the top.
All right.
And I'll do my best to get something halfway intelligent out there.
How do you get out of a boring job?
So here's how you get out of a boring job the right way, not the Gary Vee way. The Gary Vee way is like, all right, just, you know, walk in the office tomorrow and say you quit. I think that that's ridiculous. Okay, so the way that you get out of a boring job the right way is you start running little mini experiments, what it would be like to do something else. Okay, so maybe you've got an entrepreneurial idea that you want to try out. Start running those little experiments. Okay, maybe there's another company in mind. Start doing those that little bit of outreach. Start connecting on LinkedIn. Start talking to people who work at the company. Don't quit your job without something in the background, because what happens is when you quit your job, you've got nothing. Your stress levels are going to spike. Always try to play from a position of power when you have a job. You know, I understand some people are working around the clock. They're wiped out. They're tired. You got to carve out a little bit of extra time to do this while you still have the job. If you absolutely just have to quit the job, here's what I like to say. You don't know how to do the other thing until you do it. So as long as your timeline for making this work, this new job, this entrepreneurial opportunity, this side hustle, it's going to take two or three times longer than you think for it to work out. Because you don't know. You could read the book. You can go in the Facebook group. You can, you know, watch all the YouTube videos on whatever it is that you're trying to do. Until you actually do it, you don't know how to do it in your bones. So it's going to take a lot longer than you think to make that transition. So stack a little bit of cash up if you can, or be prepared to go on the ramen diet for a couple months, because, you know, that's what it's going to take. In my experience, when I transitioned from, you know, a salary bonus structure on Wall Street to kind of going off and doing my own thing, it didn't just take months. It took years. Mm-hmm. So be prepared for that. And the frustration of it not working out straight away, it doesn't mean that you're not going to be successful eventually. It just means that right now, man, you've got a lot to learn. Times it by three. If you think it's going to take 2 months, it's going to take 6 months, right? Like, that's just how it goes. So if you're prepared for that, you've got a little money socked away, maybe you're prepared to tighten up the old belt, you know, a little bit and cut the dinners out, cut whatever it is that you're doing, right? Stop going to the auto parts store and putting LEDs under your ride. Like, cut something, right? Yeah. And just get yourself that little time to be able to make that transition. It's just not going to be quick.
What do you think of, like, the people that are, like, for example, the people that have, like, a plan A and a plan B, but, like, they have the plan B to fall back on, but, like, do you think that's something to do in the right way, or do you think that you should only have a plan A and reiterate that plan A?
Two different questions, right? So if you're working at the grocery store, right, to pay the bills, grocery store was never plan A. Your plan A might be to record that album or to start that company. Grocery store is not plan A, and it ain't plan B either, right? So what plan B is, well, the record didn't come out quite how I wanted it, so maybe I'll just work on a tour as a tour manager. Then we start settling.
Yeah.
If it's settling, right, then we're in the plan B, plan C territory. No plan B's for me. No plan B's for me. It's plan A. And if plan A doesn't work out, then we find another plan A. We don't put a plan B that sucks, that you hate, that you're like, well, if I can't be a rock star, I guess I'll just fix guitars. You know? And that's something. And by the way, if you like to fix guitars, it's a great job. Join a tour and have a lot of fun. But not if you want to be the star.
Mm-hmm.
Not if you want to write the music.
Yeah.
Don't go into settle mode, plan B mode, prematurely. Find a new plan A. My plan A's have blown up so many times, and I replace them with another plan A, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, technically, social media right now is a plan A for me, but it was never in the plans 5 or 6 years ago. TikTok didn't even exist in the capacity it does now 5 or 6 years ago. So plan A's, man, you know, if you're in a job that you hate, that was never plan A.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, okay, I got to pay the bills. You got to pay the bills. There's nothing wrong with that, but make sure that you're defining what plan A is, and don't you dare create a plan B that kind of looks like plan A, but it's a little bit more likely to work out. Don't do that.
I got you. What is early 20s and 30s life advice you could give?
When you're younger, okay, let's say 20s, you're trying to take in as much information from the real world as possible. I don't mean take that weird pottery class that you've always been eyeing down in the college brochure. What I mean is fly to Amsterdam with $50 in your pocket. Like, that's what I mean. Take in as much information as possible when you have no family, probably no rent, probably no bills besides making sure you have a slice of pizza at the end of the night. Like, take it all in your 20s. And then you're supposed to, now look at me, I'm still taking it all in, like, you know, it's never ends. You're supposed to apply what you've taken in your 20s and apply it to your 30s to make it work for you, okay? This is when we get down to business, right? That's what your 30s are supposed to be about.
Okay.
This might happen in your 40s, it might happen in your 50s, whatever, right? But the idea is the younger you are, the more you should be soaking up and taking things in, worrying less about the paycheck, worrying less about immediate returns, you know, and worrying about how much you're learning so you can apply it at a later date. The idea is to become versatile and dangerous across a lot of different areas, not just business, health, fitness, whatever it is. Make sure you're eating right. Like, when I was in my 20s, I was bouncing between just like either eating boiled chicken or like living on pizza. You know, like neither of those, I don't think you could survive on either of those diets, right?
No.
So, no, not advisable. Yeah, you guys could catch me in my 20s in the Upper East Side eating either boiled chicken or Joe's Pizza. That's basically about it. Yeah, all the rest of my money, I think, was spent on vodka sodas at that point. You're a sponge in your 20s, and then you're starting to apply and test this stuff in your 30s. That's a great paradigm, okay? And by the way, you don't have to be 20. If you're 18, come on, man. Get out there and start absorbing that experience. Like, this is how you become, wise really fast. Because all wisdom is, back in the day, it's like, the wise traveler approached my door. He's wise because he's done things. He's not wise. He doesn't say, hey, I read a lot of books, guys. You should trust me. It's like, no, I've been to faraway lands. I've dealt with some crazy shit. I've seen monsters, you know, sea monsters, whatever it is.
Folk tales, whatever.
But they're real.
Yeah.
You know, so you show up. And you've got all this experience. That's wisdom. Try to get as much of that early as possible. And then you're playing the refining game as you get older.
Mm-hmm. So how do you provide wealth and create a culture of wealth for your family and friends?
Yeah. You've got to create an environment where learning new stuff is rewarded, right? So sharing information with your peers, with your family, like, this is good. In other words, being a dumbass isn't a good idea in your peer group or in your family. Not knowing something or being not willing to explore and investigate and try something new, that's what should be stopped in its tracks, right? You should be rewarding. Hey, you tried that new thing. That was crazy. Congratulations. Like, you know, you get the best seat at the house at the family Friday pizza party. Like, whatever it is, like, you should be rewarding taking new shots on goal, right? And then making sure that you're always learning and you're sharing knowledge. Like, my thing is, with my group of friends right now in Miami, all we're doing is sharing information and knowledge. Like, we sit around the dinner table. It's like, yeah, we have this, we have the same stupid, you know, guys conversation everyone's having around the dinner table on Friday night. But then it veers into, what's going on? What's trending? What are you guys investing in? What are you learning about? What are you focused on? You read anything? Like, you know, or you show up. And you say, hey, you know, I've been working on this digital marketing campaign. Do you guys know anything? And your friend's like, oh, here comes Johnny Entrepreneur again. Like, dude, you got to find new friends. If your friends think you're lame for trying to get better, you know, make that change fast. Because, you know, you need that community of excellence, even if it's your buddies on, you know, whatever you do. Go sit at the bar and watch the game on Friday night, whatever it is.
I got you. But, like, in that sense, what if you have and you truly believe the idea that you're presenting, but your friends and family are like, nah, you shouldn't do that. I don't like that. You have to do something else. How do you go about that?
Number one, when you have naysayers, right? We're talking about naysayers, friends and family, whatever it is. Make sure that they know what they're talking about. And if they do, maybe you should reconsider what it is you're doing. If they have no idea what they're talking about, you can calmly and quietly ignore their advice. Because it's meaningless. If mom and dad are, you know, legendary Wall Street traders and they're like, you know, Tommy, that strategy you're working on just doesn't seem that great. And you're like, you don't get me, mom and dad. It's like, no. You should listen to mom and dad. If mom and dad are lawyers and you're saying, you know, I took on this case and I really see some upside. And they're like, you're going to get crushed. You should probably listen to them. But if you're saying, you know, guys, I created this digital art exhibit where anyone can log on, they can look at the art, and there's an admission fee, and I think I'm going to make $1 million a month, and they say, well, you know, I don't think that's a great idea, and, you know, mom and dad work at the elementary school, you know, whatever, mom's the principal and dad's like a math teacher, you can calmly and quietly ignore every single thing that they that comes out of their mouth when it comes to that. That's all I got to say about that.
Mm-hmm. But what if they're, like, preventing you from doing that? You know what I'm saying? Like, what if they're stopping you? They're holding you back. How do you go about that?
Yeah, well, that's when things get tough. Because if someone is truly preventing you or impeding you from growing and learning, that's when it can get nasty. Because that's when you really do have to break away. And I think parents should really understand the difference between guidance and preventing learning, evolution, exploring an idea. There's a huge difference there. Someone says, hey, don't go in that room. Okay, fine. And there's a person that says, I'm standing in the entrance. Don't go through me. Yeah. One situation is going to end pretty poorly in violence, in chaos. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants that, right?
I got you. What are, like, the best credit cards to get when you turn 18 or right before you turn 18?
Here's the deal with credit cards. Big bank, big brand name credit card. I don't want to name names because this show is mm-hmm. not sponsored by anybody in the credit card banking business, whatever. I'm not going to recommend anything. Low fees. Read the damn fees, okay, and just start building credit. What that means is pay it off every single month. Doesn't mean you need to run up a $2,000 credit card bill every month. A couple $100, okay. Maybe you throw the burgers on that card and you pay it off every month. That's how you build credit. Doesn't matter if you're using, you know, the bank that starts with a C or the bank that starts with a J, whatever it is. Build credit. Make sure you read that long document that on the website where they, you know, it's like you have to scroll 150 times just to see, you know, oh, do you accept? Yeah, actually read that, because here's the deal. If you miss the payment on your burgers and the interest rate is 35%, yeah, that's a problem.
I got you. So did you learn, when did you start doing this yourself? Like, did you start doing this at 18? Like, or how did you find out which card to get for my age right now?
I got lucky. My parents were like, you need to get a credit card. You need to start paying it off. You need to start building some credit. So I think I had a credit card where you didn't have to pay it off at the end of every month. What that means is you got to be vigilant. You got to pay it off every month, or you start to run up an interest payment. And that's how people get into credit card debt on ridiculous purchases, yeah. Right? And then later I signed up for a credit card where you have to pay it off at the end of every month. So I'm sure everyone's heard of American Express. American Express functions a little differently than credit cards. It only extends you short-term credit. American Express extends you 30 days of credit. That's it. So you have to pay it off at the end of every month. A little bit different, but I love it personally because it keeps you out of so much darn trouble. I'm not recommending you go out and get an American Express card, but it keeps you away from running up bills you can't afford to pay at the end of every single month. I don't use debt in these huge blocks. Like if I do a lesson on TikTok or Instagram, I talk about, you know, billionaires using debt to purchase buildings, commercial real estate. I use debt in small chunks, small time frames. Like if I know I have 50 grand coming in next month, I might let that credit card lapse and just have that. I know that payment is coming in 45 days instead of 30 days, right? Very rarely do I do that. But if I just have a huge expense 1 month and I know, you know, let's pretend an advertiser is paying me net 30, which I really hardly ever sign on for. So that means someone can pay you in 30 days from the time of the signing of the contract. So let's pretend I sign in the middle of the month. It's the 15th, right? I don't get that thing for another 30 days. It's like, well, maybe my credit card payment was due. I'll let it lapse. And when I receive the money, I'll pay it off in full. So I use it in these little business, you know, your business credit cards usually have more flexible terms about when, but short-term debt, that's how I use debt. Another way that I don't know if I would call this debt is a line of credit. So I have a portfolio with common stock in it. Okay. Nothing crazy, nothing exotic. Well, maybe a few things. I'm obsessed with battery technology and what. Anyway, the bottom line is most of the stock here is pretty, you know, household names, pretty stable, and you can borrow against that. That's called a line of credit. So what that means is if I have $1 million of stock, I can go and take 700 grand out in cash, okay? And then I can go and use that cash to hopefully buy another asset with, not be a jackass. You don't take that cash and go buy a depreciating asset. Yeah. Like, you know, I don't go buy Supreme and Louis Vuitton duffel bags and think that was a good use of my 700 grand. The whole thing with a line of credit, if you're in a really volatile stock market, not a good idea. Not a good idea, especially if things can continue to drop. The idea is like the bank doesn't loan you 100% of your portfolio, obviously. Mm-hmm. They loan you usually about 70%. That's why I gave the example of 700 grand on a million.
Yeah.
And they can tell you to pay it back at any time. So they can call you up and say, yo, Nick, we need that 700 grand back tomorrow. And if you don't pay it back, they'll sell your stock. You know, I made this video called Billionaire Math. I made this video about, you know, Elon Musk bargaining against his portfolio to pay his rent, whatever it is. Guys, this stuff is not free money, you know, in the purest sense. You have to be really, really careful. It's not something that you're just going to like, oh, sweet, I'll just buy all the stock and just get free money out of it. It's like, no. Markets move. Banks get nervous when markets move. The terms, understand the terms of your line of credit. It's not free. It doesn't come without risk. But it can be, in certain scenarios, for experienced investors, a good way to free up some cash if you're someone that likes to be fully invested in something. If you are at a low income, meaning you're probably earning an hourly wage, your focal point should be raising that hourly wage. If you're earning $10 an hour, you need to start finding ways to earn $30 an hour, however it is. Whether it's stacking on a side hustle that equals that out, the bottom line is you need to buy yourself freedom in time. Okay, because if you're just working around the clock, and this is like, I know this, having, you know, after Wall Street, played in a rock band, spent millions of bucks, went to zero, was working in a clothing store, earning $14 an hour. Dude, when you're earning $14 an hour, you can't do anything but work. You're basically only working. And when you come home and, you know, having worked this retail job, you fall flat on your face. If you're smart, if you're an idiot, you go and take that money out to the bar. And I saw plenty of people do that. That's New Orleans for you, I guess. But the idea is try to raise that rate to just buy yourself a day. Sunday. All right, Saturday, let's bring everyone over and get trash and throw, you know, have a barbecue in the backyard. It's like, no. Get organized. Get planning. Decide how the heck you're going to get out of this environment. Take a real hard look at what you do, what you like, what your skills are, and start building out that plan. You need to raise your hourly rate to buy yourself that Sunday, to buy yourself that Saturday, whatever day it is of the week. It doesn't matter. I know from experience, you're earning 10 bucks an hour, you're working 7 days a week, and you don't have time to think. You don't have time to plan. So get that hourly rate up at all costs. Even if it means, you know, you're at the store, you're like, hey, guys, like, you know, can I take on some more responsibility? Can I close? Whatever it is, right? Just up that hourly rate, and that's going to buy you out a day a week. And that day of the week is when you go full planning mode, full throttle. And that's how you're eventually going to get out of it.
How did you do it when you worked at the clothing store and you started doing that? You made that agency, the resume one. How did you manage to get those hours back to do that?
I built my resume writing company from the break room. So instead of taking a break and, you know, going out and, I don't know, eating on the back porch of this freaking clothing store, right? I sat there and I started looking for different types of jobs online. And I saw that resume writing was, at the time, really highly paid. I'm like, well, I could do this, you know? And so instead of like over-intellectualizing, I just did it. I started applying for jobs. So from the break room, I started applying for jobs on freelancing platforms to write resumes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So trust me, when you go from having millions of dollars to having zero or practically zero, you lose your ego pretty fast. You're like, I just need money, and I need money fast, and I need money at a higher hourly rate than what I'm earning at the store. So resume writing, right? I'd sell executive resumes. And it was pretty, I'm not saying I was selling something I wasn't good at. I was very good at this task, and I got much better over time. But the idea is, in hourly terms, I was earning 10 times what I was earning at the clothing store. Mm-hmm. See how the creativity plays in my favor here? Like,
yeah.
Clothing store, I earned, let's say, $10 an hour. Writing executive resumes, $100 an hour. Boom, there's my free days. Yeah. With those free days, that's how I started to hire additional writers, train them, and turn Resume Atelier into a great lifestyle business that supported me for about six years. So at a high quality of life. And also, once you build and scale a business, you get free time again. Mm-hmm. Go and do it again. Go and do it again. Go make some TikToks, you know?
Exactly. How do you manage risk and do proper due diligence?
Okay, here's the whole thing with managing risk. I've seen a lot of the comments come through, especially on Instagram. What's a good amount to have lost, Nick, in an investment? And all I can think of is, oh God, what crypto coin did you lose your entire life savings on? Okay, here's the answer. If you're trading, you can trade with a percentage, a single digit percentage of your net worth. Okay, mm-hmm. So for most people, that's a number in their bank account. Right? For the people who that's in terms of mansions, yachts, and they're probably not the ones that are asking this question, right? Yeah. So if you've got $1,000 in your bank account, OK, Okay, you're not going to like the answer to this, guys. Don't risk more than 10% of that. You know how much money that is?
Like
$100.
Yeah, less than.
Okay, so if you're sitting there and going, I got $1,000. I'm going to lever this up 10x, trade, like I have 10,000 bucks, and then directionally bet on some fucking make-believe coin. No, 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 my friend. You have just made a drastic error. You've put more than 10% of your entire net worth at risk. Dude, there is nothing different than that than being hammered, walking into a Vegas casino, and putting it all on black. Like, that's what crazy people do. Just because you're in your apartment and you have five computers for some reason and you're like, you think you're like just seeing through the matrix. Like, dude, you are making a drastic mistake. You're tricking yourself into thinking you have any idea what you're doing. And you have no idea what you're doing. Trust me. I know you have no idea what you're doing. I'm pointing at you. You didn't do anything. You didn't do anything bad.
No, that's a great point. That's a great, really great point. What are like three stock market tips though that you could give out that most majority of people can really follow for like beginners, I guess?
Stock picking, meaning choosing individual stocks, is a job. That's a job. Mm-hmm. So if you already have a job, why the hell are you trying to take on another job? Stock picking and portfolio management, you know, with the five screens and the, you know, you've got the Red Bull and you're just like, I'm just in the matrix, guys. You don't even understand how good I am at this. That is a full-time job. So what that means is 99% of people shouldn't be doing it. Now, what do? If you're not picking single stocks, what are you doing? Indexes, okay? We know that in the long run, the S&P 500, that's the broad market, okay, is spitting off, what, about 8%, 8 to 15% over the long run, meaning you got to have this thing in there for 10 years because there's huge swings, you know, no surprise to anybody who's just lived through the past couple months, right? That's what you play in because an index fund, S&P 500, an ETF, exchange-traded fund that mirrors the S&P, that's not a job. That's, hey, okay, every month I've got an extra $500. I'll put it in the S&P. And then call me when you're 60 years old. Don't you dare look at it. Okay, that's not a job. You can do that. Now, finally, well, I think my final point is really a mix of the first. It's be in it for the long haul. So if you think you're Johnny Trader, you know, Johnny Wall Street, like just stop right now. Not because I don't think you're smart. It's you're playing three-dimensional poker, five-dimensional poker with the smartest people on earth, and you're doing it part-time? No, no, no. Long-term, not so exciting, not so boring. But if you guys want to bet, you know, just go to Vegas. It's going to be more fun, you know?
Do you day trade at all or?
Me?
Yeah.
No. Because when I day trade, I lose lots and lots of money because I'm not working on a trading floor anymore. I have no information. I have no speed of information, meaning I get information faster than you do. That's one the experience that you have on a trading floor. I had a $30,000 a month subscription to Bloomberg. I have real-time data. I have chats. I have flow. I see customer. I see everything. What am I doing now? I'm sitting in my house in Miami looking out the window at people walking by in bathing suits. I've got no information at all. Okay. Like why would I be day trading? No. What I do is I'm a thematic investor. Thematic. Theme. You have a theme. My theme is electric vehicles. I'm in pain right now. Okay. If you look at the market, battery technology. And in the private market, it's AI. Mm-hmm. That's what I like. Okay. Now let's talk about why I become a little picker there. Because I know something about that space. All I do is think and learn and educate myself on that space. Talk to people in that space. Mm-hmm. I have a deep belief in that space.
I got you.
But do I own one company? No, I own a basket of companies. So I'm diversified across a basket of companies. I'm not diversified from an industry standpoint. And that's how I roll. And I still own S&Ps, S&P 500 ETF. I don't care which ETF you buy, the Vanguard, whatever it is. That's how I roll. Oh, and by the way, I'm not actively managing the portfolio. I have a portfolio that I'm not really touching. I'm like, I've established my weights. I have a spreadsheet. I didn't steal it from someone online. I made it myself. I said, okay, this is how I want to balance my portfolio. Okay, I've got 50% in this stock, and then I'll have 25% here, and then we'll have smaller bets in more risky companies. More money in the stable, shit, and less as it gets risky and creepy and scary in companies you've never heard of.
Yeah.
That's how I build my portfolio. I balance it out, meaning if one goes to the moon and I'm only supposed to have 5% dollar weighted average, I sell some of it and stick it back into the rest of the stuff. Balancing, this is called portfolio balancing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm not day trading. I'm just managing and balancing a really simple thematic portfolio. I can't decide if I like thematic. I feel like thematic makes me sound like an asshole. Thematic, thematic. Okay. I don't care. You guys decide.
How do you identify and analyze good business opportunities, and how do you know how to bring someone along?
Okay, so a couple criteria here. Three questions I ask myself. Number one, do I have specialized knowledge or information? The example is, okay, if I'm investing in an engineering company, am I an engineer or do I know jack shit about engineering? If you're an engineer, continue on the list. Number two, can I add value to it? This is different between public markets and private markets. Private markets, you're that smart engineer. You call up the founder, you say, hey guys, I'm looking at what you're doing. Have you thought about this? You're adding value to the business now. It's kind of like cheating, but it's not. It's legal. It's legal to help people in a, right, in this environment. Not, this isn't insider trading, guys. Like this private company, you call them up, you say, I was just reading through this stuff, the project you're working on. Have you thought about this, solving this? Can I add value? If yes, continue on the list. Okay, number three, what's inside my control and outside of my control? Again, this looks a lot like public-private. You know, mm-hmm. if you own common stock in a huge company, you have no say in anything that goes on. If you're Carl Icahn, you own a chunk of the company, they have the shareholder meeting, and you can stand up and say all the crazy shit that you want to say and nudge decision-making in the right direction that's going to be more profitable for the company. Most people have no say. If you can't check all of those boxes, okay, don't invest in it. Don't even think about investing in it. If you could check all three of those boxes, have at it. See how impossible it is to invest in something when you create this criteria? Mm-hmm. Right, so you have to say no to more things than you say yes to when it comes to investing, because you absolutely need to methodically go through down the list and say, like, do I even know what this is? Am I able to add value to this discussion in any way, shape, or form? And is this completely outside of my control? Most people say no, no, no when they buy a stock or they buy a coin or they buy some crate, you know, there's scenarios where you're not checking all three boxes, right? Like certain things, like there's REITs, right? Real estate investment trust. So it's like, okay, well, I'm not calling up the REIT and telling them that I don't like that building because there's mildew in the lobby or something like that. Like, but you understand, hopefully, you understand real estate, you understand their buying strategy, their investing strategy. You have some deep knowledge there. You like how the portfolio is structured. You trust the management team, whatever it is. And you start to check more of these boxes than not. But most people can't check a single one of these boxes, which means you shouldn't be doing it in the first place.
Okay. How do you persuade a sale without like manipulation tactics or exploitation of the other party? You kind of explained it there with the adding value, but...
Yeah, for sure. So you have to make sure the thing that you're selling is adding value to society and making the world a better place. If you're selling a like a trick, or you're the middleman that's just wedged in some market, like taking fees, yeah, I'd feel pretty shitty about selling that stuff too, because you're not helping the world. You're not helping fellow man advance. If you've created software that makes life easier for everybody and there's $1,000 a month price tag on it, what do you feel guilty about, right? That $1,000 a month price tag has a multiple for that business. They use your software, they pay you $1,000 and they make $3,000, right? Or they bring in $3,000 of revenue and they pull in $2,000 in profit. I'd be able to sell that thing in my sleep, right? You're adding value. It's a quality product. You believe in the team that you're working with. You know, if you're sitting there going, like, oh man, I don't know why I'm selling this thing anymore. Well, maybe you're selling something sketchy or working at a crappy business and it's just time to change. And let me tell you, your sales skills are going to light up like a freaking Christmas tree the moment that you realize that you're selling something that's high quality, adding value. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Don't manipulate. That's not sales, guys. That's conning.
Put you in jail.
Maybe. If you're lucky, at least you'd learn something.
Also in that like same type of realm, what basic requirements do you use, since you used to be a freelancer yourself, used to hire freelancers?
Yeah. So this is I use this crazy framework that I stole from Israeli fighter pilot training. Okay. So this is going to sound crazy, guys, but trust me, it works. All right. There's been studies run about how to train and onboard, I don't think that's the right word, in the military, effective pilots. Basically, when you're a fighter pilot, you're getting handed $10 million piece of equipment, whatever it is. I think it's probably more than that. You're getting handed something insanely expensive that you can probably fuck up, break, blow up, and die in, right? Yeah. So making this decision about who becomes a fighter pilot and who doesn't, pretty important. There were some consultants that jumped in and helped the Israeli military determine how to make the best choices, because they found that, let's say a general sitting there doing the interviews, they found that who he liked or who she liked didn't have any correlation to the best fighter pilots. So meaning a human sitting and going like, yep, Johnny's the one, you know, or Susie's the one. It's like 50% of the time they screwed up the job or they weren't any good, right? Mm-hmm. So check this out. There's a way that you create a list of the most important things that a person can do in a role. And it's small. Like, hey, this person, and it's usually about 4 or 5 items. That's it. Not, hey, did you smile when you woke up this morning? Hey, what's your diet? Like, hey, blah, blah. It's like, that's how job interviews are today, right? Mm-hmm. But you basically need to, and I do use this. I use a 5-point scale. Before I hire for the role, I say, what are the 5 most important things? Screw everything else. What do they need to do? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you know what my interview is? How do you do 1? Tell me about it. What's your background and experience in 1? Okay. How do you do 2? What's your background and experience in 2? I assign them a scale from 1 to 5. Okay. For each one of the 5 points. At the end, I add it up and the person with the highest score wins. That's it. I don't have to like them. I don't have to think their haircut is cool. I don't need to, they went to the same college as me. No, the person with the highest score wins, and that predicts the best hire. Liking someone is actually not a predictor of the right person for the role.
Yeah, I understand that.
So, dude, I'm using some advanced techniques here. By the way, advanced techniques that are so easy to use.
Where'd you even learn about that?
It's in a book. It's in a book, man. It's Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. It's a really popular book. He consulted with the Israeli military and, he breaks down the strategy. And again, like, I don't just read this stuff in a book and just go, it's got to be true. Like, I do it or I have my team do it. And then we do it and we're like, oh, man, that worked really well. Also, guys, spend less time interviewing. Interviews have to be efficient. When you're interviewing for a role, you might talk to 20, 30, you know how long? It's 20, 30 hours, depending on the role. So the 5-pointer, man, it saved me a ton of time. I really use it in real life. I just hired someone based on this scale too.
I got you. Speaking of books, what are your top 3 books?
What did I write down? Because this changes. Master's Secret Whispers by Kapil Gupta. What a strange book. But you have to read this because it shows you that there's a different paradigm to thinking about the universe. Basically, is hard work the answer or is play the answer? Do you have to grind forever to get what you want? Or could you just do it in this effortless, calm, and cool, collected way? Master Secret Whispers, heck of a book. You've never heard of it before. Check it out. Okay, just to have your mind completely blown into question everything, there's a book called The Sovereign Individual. It looks like a freaking textbook. It is gigantic. So if you don't like, whatever it is, a 5-inch freaking textbook sitting on your bookshelf, put it on the Kindle. It's going to take you a couple months. It might take you 2 months to read. This book will blow your mind. Because it'll teach you basically what they call mega political structures. So the structures of power in the world, where'd they come from? Why do we pay taxes? Why do we vote? Where'd all this stuff come from? Mm-hmm. Right? Like everyone takes this stuff for granted and they have like no idea why we do it. It's like, well, that guy didn't pay his taxes. Well, why? What's the loophole? Why is there a loophole? What are taxes? Like this book answers all of that. It takes you back to like medieval times where, if someone was stealing all your vegetables and you were tired of chasing them off of your farm, eventually someone came and said, hey, I'll protect you. You just got to pay me some money and I'll send some knights down there to scare these jerks away from your farm. Who do you think that guy was? He was the king. And there was a reason you gave money to him, because he protected you. Why do you pay taxes now? So when your house lights on fire, somebody shows up and puts it out. When someone knocks you over the head and takes your Rolex, hopefully they don't do it in the first place. Yeah. Preventative, right? All these are public services that you pay for with taxes. You ever think about it like that? All right, finally, here's a total weird book, Psycho-Cybernetics. This is written in the 1970s by a plastic surgeon who basically decided that there's this thing called your self-image. So if a super handsome guy got into a car accident, his face got messed up, he would dip into depression. He wouldn't see himself inside as the same valuable person that he was when he was a handsome, good-looking guy, right? As a surgeon, he would go and he would be this beautiful surgeon. He'd put your face back together. You'd become you again. Mm-hmm. What he found was some people became them again. Some people stayed the same, still thought they were ugly, still became depressed. And so he created this idea of your self-image, or he refined this idea of your self-image in that if you can repair your self-image, you can achieve anything because of the congruity of having this self-image of yourself. If you're like, I'm just a go-getter kind of guy, and you believe that, well, then you are a go-getter kind of guy. I'm just so sad and depressed. I can't even look in the mirror. All right, well, you're not going to accomplish much with that belief, with that self-image. So this book is the gateway into visualization. Check it out. None of these, I'm not sponsored by any of these authors. Most of them, I think 2 of them are dead. definitely one of them is dead. So I love these books. And again, you ask me tomorrow, it'll probably change. But these books are top of mind right now.
I got you. What movie character do you relate to?
Dude, I deleted this from the list. Guys, I deleted this from the list.
Oh, you don't want to answer?
And, well, no, it's not that I don't want to answer it. It's I don't know if I have a good enough answer because...
I liked when you said Jay Gatsby and the aspect of that and how you maneuvered in that conversation. But
yeah, I mean, Great Gatsby, an incredible book, a halfway decent movie, right? Like that character for me will always go down as one of the greatest characters ever written in American culture because that's the paradigm. It's go and get it. Don't become a bootlegger or do something stupid and illegal like Gatsby did. Okay, but go and get it and have a good reason for it. That's why I love Gatsby. Heart of gold. You know, I don't care that he, West egg, East egg, new money, old money bullshit. That doesn't mean anything to me. Okay, if you're a go-getter and you didn't wake up a billionaire, okay, well then who gives a shit if you get rich tomorrow and you weren't rich the day before, okay?
Yeah.
Gatsby has a heart of gold. He mixed up going after and getting what he wanted with the wrong strategy. He went after the wrong strategy, and he ended up getting himself in a little bit of trouble at the end. So don't replicate this guy's life, but the purity and the focus, it wouldn't hurt if you had a little bit of Gatsby in you.
Yeah, I got you, so...
I think that's it. I think that's the pod.
I think that was...
Let's wrap. I like that.
Yeah.
And I kind of got my voice. I was like, I think everybody has a little Gatsby in them.
Yeah.
That's it, everybody. Thanks.